Good evening and welcome to this town hall meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm journalist Jonathan Curiel and your moderator for today's program. As we sit here, the military conflict between the Israeli government and Hamas in Gaza continues unabated with devastating consequences. The death toll in Gaza is almost 1,000. 75% of them are civilians. This is the third conflict between Israel and Gaza in the last 7 years. And the conflict has historic proportions and also proportions that involve this week and last week. Joining me to discuss the most recent developments in the Gaza Strip are four panelists who each know the issues firsthand. George Bisharat is a professor of law at University of California Hastings School of Law and a former San Francisco public defender. Professor Bisharat studied law, anthropology, and Middle East studies at Harvard and has written frequently on Middle Eastern law and politics. Journalist Janine Zakaria was Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. She has also reported for Salon, Bloomberg News, The Jerusalem Post, Reuters, and The New Republic. She is currently teaching communications at Stanford University. Dr. Jess Ghanem is a clinical professor of psychiatry and global health sciences at the UCSF School of Medicine. His research areas include evaluating the psychological consequences of war on displaced communities and children. He has developed community health clinics in the Gaza Strip and other areas of the Middle East. And finally, John Rothman is a political analyst at San Francisco's KKSF Radio. He specializes in the United States, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe, including Russia. He has also worked in a variety of political campaigns, and in 1982 was founder and president of the Raoul Wallenberg Jewish Democratic Club. Please welcome our four panelists. I'm going to start this town panel by asking each of our guests a question related to their expertise. And I'm going to start with Dr. Jessica Ghanem. Dr. Ghanem, you were recently in Palestine, in Gaza, and that's even correct. Today I understand you were speaking to people there on the ground. You've worked there extensively, and the military conflicts often devolve into numbers. You know, 80 people died, four people, military figures died, this building collapsed. I would love you to talk about this conflict in human terms and as it relates to your expertise on the ground there.
Well, in human terms, it's quite devastating. I can tell you that I've been going to the Gaza Strip now for over 25 years, and the last time that I was there, the bleakness of existence under occupation for Palestinians in Gaza is really hard to wrap your mind around. Hopelessness, really difficulty imagining a dignified human future for themselves and their families. And although I've been seeing this, you know, over the years, there was something about this last December that I was there that was particularly troubling to me, just in terms of the psychological impact that it has on people, on children especially. Medically, we find children in Gaza, for example, have such significant low birth weights and are stunted in their ability to grow. And just the lack of humanity and the lack of dignity that Palestinians are afforded in Gaza is really difficult even for me to see, having been there for such a long time. So I would have to say, Jonathan, it was pretty bleak. And on the human side, one of my colleagues, actually, because we started a mental health clinic in Gaza, and the director of that clinic just a few days ago lost 28 members of his family. And, you know, and in a single shot of a missile to his house. And I'm the one that has to listen to these stories every single day and hear the agony and pain and despair in people's voices. The future looks pretty bleak.
Thank you. I want to next go to Janine Zakaria. You were bureau chief there for several years for The Washington Post, and you've reported extensively from Israel. You're now based here. Can you talk about what it's like to be in Israel reporting on such a conflict and what the view is there of the conflict?
Thanks very much for having me. I wish we could be here under better circumstances. I've been reporting on Israel since 1994, and This is a unique moment, and I think most of the people who have come to this appreciate that. That's why there's a sold-out house. I've reported on a lot of these kinds of situations, and there's a lot of reasons why this feels different. You could talk about reporting as a foreign correspondent, and there's been a lot of a story in the New York Times today about, you know, the how rattled the foreign press has been, but there's always been sort of an unusual relationship between the Israeli government press office that credentials foreign press, on the one hand, affording enormous access. On the other hand, it's been a very contentious relationship throughout the years. And clearly, with the advent of social media, this has become a very different situation for the Israeli military. They've tried in the past to limit coverage of Israeli operations in the West Bank and Gaza. If you recall the operation in Jenin, in the northern West Bank in 2002, which there were very few reporters who, if any, could get in there. When you had Operation Cast Lead, the major Israeli military offensive 2008-2009, there was very little coverage like we've seen this time around, either by foreign correspondents or you didn't really have so much social media. And so this time, everybody's a reporter, right? So you're getting a lot of people giving direct reports for what's happening. But that's less interesting to me than the way this is being covered in the Israeli media. And I just wrote a piece about this that just went out on Slate.com. And the reason I wanted to focus on the Israeli media, I'm a fluent Hebrew speaker, so I'm able to track what's being said, is that Prime Minister Netanyahu, if you need to understand two things about him, first, he's a politician, okay? Second, he's, if anything, a tactician, right? So the stated the military goals of this operation are destroy the tunnels, stop the rocket fire, right? But he's never been known to be a wide-thinking strategist. So if you're a little bit lost about where this is all headed or why it's happening, it's not only you, it may be him as well. And I don't say that flippantly. I really mean it. So that's that. And the Israeli military, what happened, the Israeli press shaped the way Israelis see this, even in the advent of global media, even though Israel is a high-tech nation, okay? Many people turn to their Hebrew language resources because Israel, for the last few years, long before this calamity of this war, a lot of people were saying on the streets, "Ha'olam kulo negdenu," the entire world is against us. Okay, and that is what shapes the way Israelis see this. It doesn't matter what they do. Everybody in the Bay Area, in Geneva, in whatever, no matter how many people they kill, whatever, they're going to be against them. So they might as well do what they think is in their interests. And that is the tenor that you see in the Israeli media right now, and that's why you see overwhelming support despite the horrific number of casualties on the Palestinian side. That's how they feel.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bisharat, Professor Bisharat, your specialty is law, and we've had a lot of legal issues discussed in the last week or so. Ban Ki-moon is in the area. John Kerry is in. They're talking about a legal settlement. Can you talk about the legal issues involved and what could resolve this, albeit temporarily?
There are a real tangle of legal issues that are involved in this situation. There is, of course, the fundamental question of the legal relationship between Israel and the Gaza Strip and the level of force that empowers Israel to use in respect of disturbances that occur there. The better legal analysis, I think, is that because Israel essentially controls Gaza's borders, its airspace, its electromagnetic field, provides it fuel, electricity, and the like, it continues to exercise what in law is called effective control of the Gaza Strip, meaning that it still is an occupying power for purposes of international humanitarian law. That doesn't mean that Israel has to sit on its hands if it is attacked. What it means is the level of force that has to be used is according to a policing model, not according to the model of international armed conflict. So that means that a minimum of force can be used to quell disturbances. And I think the excess of force that we're seeing employed is one of the major legal issues. There's the issue of the principle of distinction requires that militaries only target other military personnel or objects. And Israel has been, for a number of years, trying to push the boundaries of international law to allow itself greater freedom to attack targets. And in particular, its interpretation of the distinction between a combatant and a non-combatant is a very controversial, and most would say improper one. All upper-level Hamas activists are considered military targets regardless of their function. So, for example, a police chief, Taysir al-Batch, was targeted for an attack while he was in his cousin's home. He was injured. 18 members of his family were killed. Under international law, a civilian police chief is a civilian unless he is at that moment directly participating in combat. So this is an extremely problematic exercise of the principle of distinction.
Thank you. John Rothman, you often have to address issues of conflict in terms of Israel in your radio show. And I'm wondering, you know, with your long history on the subject, what is the most surprising thing you see about this current conflict?
For every action, there's a reaction. And although the title of this open forum has to do with Gaza, we would be remiss if we did not point out that in the last 18 days, more than 2,000 missiles have been fired at Israel's population centers. I say this because I want you to understand that were it not for Iron Dome, the missile defense system, Tel Aviv, Haifa, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Sderot would be in ruins. The nature of casualties would have gone into the thousands. And the question is, how do we stop reaction and counter-reaction? And the answer to me is very clear. The European Union yesterday issued a statement endorsed by President Obama and Secretary Kerry saying the missiles being fired from Gaza must stop. The Israelis have agreed to a ceasefire if the missiles stop. Mr. Mashal, the political spokesman for Hamas, has said no, they will not stop. There is yet another element to this which I think is critical. And that is that a ceasefire is not a peace agreement. There have already been a number of ceasefires over the years. It will take more than a ceasefire to prevent this from happening again. I would be remiss if I did not point out that Gaza, as those of you who have been there know, is a very small place. Hamas has been using mosques, hospitals, schools to store their missiles and to fire them. Now, I understand very clearly the objective, and I want everyone to be clear. Hamas views itself as a resistance organization, that they are resisting not only Israeli occupation, but the very existence of Israel. They call it the Zionist entity. This is a serious problem to overcome, and that is why John Kerry, despite his best efforts, has been unable to secure what he needs. One last thought. The blockade of Gaza was imposed from two sides, by Israel and by Egypt. For a brief time during the reign of the Muslim Brotherhood, the border with Egypt was a little less solid. The missiles and supplies for military action have come in across those borders. The position that has been adopted now by the European Union, by the United States, and by the Israelis is clear. If the borders are open, there must be an agreement that these weapons will not flow. From the Israeli perspective, as soon as the missiles stop flying, and I repeat, 2,000 plus in 18 days, there is a chance that perhaps we can move forward.
I'd like to segue into something that relates to what you just said. And what you just said speaks to my mind of a cycle of violence, where it's sort of a conditional, we will make peace if this happens. How can the conflict be temporarily resolved with a, we don't care what you do, we just want peace? Is that kind of peace possible right now? And I want to preface that by saying Palestinians will say, and the blockade of us first, that's the condition we have. So I'd like to ask Jess, if you can respond to that.
It's, in medicine, we like to look at the cause of a symptom rather than just getting rid of a symptom. And I just want to reflect on speaking with some people on the ground in Gaza. And I think there is a tipping point, John, and maybe Janine spoke to this a little bit, about how different things are now for people in Gaza. They were interviewing a Palestinian-American man in Gaza, and he, after he had lost, 20 of his family members, and he said, you know what? I think I'd rather die with dignity than go back to a situation of being under occupation by Israel again. The problem with the idea of stopping the rockets is that for a very, very long time, there were no rockets for very long stretches of time. And yet what Palestinians had to endure in Gaza and in the West Bank was a constant, unremitting occupation and siege of their land. And one of the things that I have, by virtue of having been there and seen the trajectory for the last 25 years, is utter destruction of a civil society, with or without rockets. And I think psychologically now we're getting to this point where, in fact, Palestinians are saying it's better to die with dignity and fight this occupation rather than go back to a situation where we're constantly oppressed. You know, historically, we need to keep in mind that that tipping point in apartheid South Africa. You know, when black South Africans who had to suffer from apartheid got restless at some point and say, you know, dying with dignity is much better than living in an apartheid regime. And I think very much so, we have to entertain the possibility that we are getting very, very close to this phenomenon among Palestinians now in Gaza. And if we do, then this becomes a total game changer in terms of all of the dynamics.
Now, just to add, I think we're there because those of you who were listening before you came in tonight to the news, there were 10,000 Palestinians on the West Bank who were marching. So if I happen to believe that the tipping point is here, I would only respond by saying that the rockets have flown repeatedly over the last 7 years. I was in Sderot 2 years ago with my son, who is here tonight, and the missiles were flying 2 days before we were there. So there have been constant missiles. But I also want to say, when you speak about how do you bring peace, I'll be blunt. There must be a recognition of Israel's right to exist as a nation without qualification in the Arab world. There's no need for applause. I just want to say this because each one of us here feels passionately. And what you're going to hear, I hope, are the descriptions, not only what we feel, but what we think. And I can tell you from the Israeli perspective, and I believe from the American perspective, and I believe from the European perspective, the continual denials of Israel's right to exist as a nation simply precludes the possibility of direct negotiation. So I would hope, as a first step, the rockets stop flying, there is an agreement to a ceasefire, that Hamas agrees to sit and talk directly with the Israelis. Hamas has controlled Gaza since 1987, and one of the tragedies is that they did not build a society there that would begin the process of negotiation. That is my view.
Okay. Janine Zakaria, you've reported from the region. One of the many themes that have come up in the last 2 weeks has been the vitriol that has become public on both sides. Let us not forget that the retaliation killing of a Palestinian in Jerusalem, which to my mind was unprecedented, but unprecedented before that was the killing of three Israeli young Israelis on their way back from the West Bank. But can you talk about how the enmity really on both sides has reached an incredible point, especially in Israel, but also in Gaza, and also how that might relate historically to the conflict?
It's Sorry, I'm a little bit emotional about this right now. Usually I'm a very dispassionate analyst, reporter on all this, but it's gotten to me this time. I just had a baby, too, so that could be why. A little postpartum. Look, for a long time now, Israelis, I think on balance, have been post-Palestinian. John's right that there have been rockets, you know, hundreds over the past few years. Jess is right, too. There have been quieter periods. But for the most part, it's been so quiet that Israelis have been able to say, I don't want to think about this Palestinian issue anymore, right? Yeah. And they don't want to think about it. They want to be high-tech nation. They want to move on. I mean, it's one of these incredible places, right? They want the world to see them not as an occupying force with a blockade of Gaza, but as, you know, developing Waze, which, you know, sold for $1 billion in Silicon Valley, right? But these kind of things keep happening. So in the absence of any peace effort, okay, and in the absence of any U.S. leadership on this, because, mind you, after Kerry's last failure, apart from this struggle he's having to negotiating a ceasefire, they're checked out. The United States, we are checked out until at least 2017, okay, until the next presidency, and it's going to take a while. So there's nobody manning the store here, okay? It's like kids fighting a little bit in the playground. So there hasn't been any real thought about, you know, what to do now in the absence of that. I remember, for example, being when I was there for the Post in early 2010, and I went to see a senior Israeli official. We're talking about Iran and Syria and all these different things. And I said, what about Gaza? Can you explain Israel's policy towards Gaza to me? And he looked at me and he said in Hebrew, Mat lo mevina, what don't you understand? Like he was a little bit, what do you, it's so clear, right? We have the blockade. They're bringing the missiles in. We got to stop it. You know, that's it, right? I'm like, yeah, but you've had this blockade and Hamas is still in power and I thought your objective was, you know, kind of deteriorated into this whole debate. 2 months later, you had the flotilla. Remember the flotilla? When the Turkish aid ship tried to reach Gaza. Now, to me, and then the Israelis had a nighttime raid, very militaristic. They killed 9 Turks on board. The whole world was said, oh, my God, what's this Gaza blockade? People started paying attention again, right? This was a moment when Israelis should have said, okay, what's going on with our Gaza policy? Is it right? Is it helping us? Is it serving our interests? And that just didn't happen, right? And so I think to me that was like a wake-up call. Similarly on the West Bank, right, when you talk to Israeli Shin Bet, that's the domestic security officials, back then, 2010, 2011, when I was there, they said, we've got about another 18 months to 2 years until there's a third intifada. Okay, this is beneath the surface. Palestinians getting frustrated. What's going on, you know? And it wasn't only, people don't realize, we, the United States, spent a lot of money to train a Palestinian security force in the West Bank, and this is an important point that's gotten lost here, that has been successful in cracking down on Hamas in the West Bank, okay? And the killing of the 3 yeshiva students, which really was, if you want to look at a point where this whole Redison episode started, it's that, right? That was an aberration, not the norm, in terms of what's going on in the West Bank, okay? So you have this crazy situation where when there's no U.S. leadership, there's no peace process, there's no vision for going forward, there's no reflection in Israeli society about what to do about the occupation of the Palestinians, where these incidents, like the 3 yeshiva students murdered, like the Palestinian teenager murdered, like the rockets start, like Israel says they got to do it, just everything loses control. And unfortunately, that's where we're at now.
And we are, of course, at a point of finger pointing and recriminations. One of the questions we have from tonight's audience is, are we past the point of a two-state solution? That's a question I'm sure each of you could answer at length. But I'm going to ask Professor Bisharat to address that in any way that he wants.
Well, Meron Benvenisti, who was deputy mayor of Jerusalem back in the mid-'80s, in 1985, claimed that we had already passed the point beyond which a two-state solution was no longer possible. With nearly 700,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied territories in the East Jerusalem and the West Bank, yes, I believe we're past the point of no return with respect to the two-state solution. What we have and have had for a long period of time is a one-state reality. People live under one functioning sovereignty, but they live according to different legal principles. And if you really get right down to it, that is the definition of apartheid, or that is at least an expression or form of apartheid. I think the question going forward, and it's extremely challenging, I understand that entirely, are we? These people are going to be living together in the future. There's neither group of people is going away in large numbers. They are going to live together. They are inextricably entwined. The question is, are they going to live under principles of apartheid, or are they going to live under principles of equality? And I think the answer to that ought to be clear to everybody. It's going to take some time for that to happen, but that will be the result. It'll be 30 to 50 years from now, but that will be the end result of this.
So thank you. I want to get back to something that Janine said about how it may be till 2017 that the U.S. is seriously involved again in the process. That's a rather sobering and frankly sad idea. I understand why
I'm happy to be challenged on it if anybody thinks I'm wrong on that.
No, I'm going to ask John perhaps to go with that idea, but with this caveat, as it were, why shouldn't the U.S. essentially intervene in a way that say they might have in the 1970s? I don't mean militarily. I mean diplomatically.
I want to remind you, when we've had successful interventions in the Middle East, the Egypt-Israel peace treaty is a great example. The declaration of principles between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that is Yasser Arafat and the mainline PLO, and the peace treaty that was negotiated between Israel and Jordan, that the parties themselves initiated the first steps. We did not do anything more or less than grease the tracks, primarily with funding. In order for a two-state solution to emerge, there has to be a will on the part of both sides for such an agreement to emerge. I agree with George that the odds of a two-state solution have slipped away. I reject the notion that Israel is an apartheid society, something I know we could debate back and forth. It's not necessarily the subject here today. But there is no doubt that unless the Palestinian Authority emerges, and the operative word here is authority, with authority over both the West Bank and Gaza, there is no one to talk to, and certainly no one who can deliver. And that applies equally to the role of Egypt, where a democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood president was removed in what the United States declines to call a coup, but it was, laying the groundwork for the military to assume control. From our perspective, the United States, we would rather have, and you can say this is right or wrong, we would rather have a Shah, a Sadat, a Begin, a Hussein, an Assad in Syria who is not gone because of our fear that if he goes, the radical Islamists will take over. And although I want to stop, but I want you to know what is happening in the Islamic State, the creation within Iraq and Syria of a new nation, which, by the way, has just expelled a 2,000-year-old Christian community from a city which we fought and bled and died for during the Iraq incursion. All of these things operate, resonate, and make more difficult the task that we have.
I want to remind our radio audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking about the current crisis in Gaza. Our guests are George Bisharat, UC Hastings Professor of Law, Janine Zakaria, journalist and Stanford Professor of Communications, Dr. Jess Ghanem, Clinical Professor of Psychiatry and Global Health Sciences at UCSF School of Medicine, and John Rothman, radio host and Chief Political Analyst at KKSF Radio. I'm Jonathan Curiel, your moderator. We've gotten lots of questions from the audience about Hamas and about their responsibility in the crisis. There are some who are saying that Hamas essentially is to blame for fumbling what was an opportunity after Israeli withdrawal in 2005, and that they fumbled their opportunity. There are others who say that Hamas really didn't have a chance. And certainly there have been analysts who say, we talked about this earlier in the program, about Israeli control of the borders and how Israel didn't recognize the Hamas Fatah Palestinian Authority government. Can you talk about that a little bit, Dr. Ghanem, even if it's from a personal standpoint, talking to Hamas members or just your experience on the ground there?
Yeah, I think on the ground people are tired of ineffectual leadership, and I could say that speaking to Israelis or Palestinians, I think the lack of leadership on either side could be articulated, very, very well. But, you know, what Janine said, that maybe what sparked some of this had to do with the killing of the three yeshiva students. You know, there's another, I think, more plausible, if not equally, good analysis of that, is that, we did have unity between the Palestinian factions. Hamas and Fatah actually came together and said, we're going to put down our differences, we're going to have a single address, we're going to be on the same page. And when that happened, the Israelis became apoplectic. I mean, they were just furious at the idea that there could be Palestinian unity. And even the specter of a unity created so much anxiety among Israelis, because then there would be a single address, there would be a single unified political position, and, that is kind of a nightmare, I think, to the Israelis, despite what John thinks is that we're looking for someone to talk to, there's no one to talk to. Actually, we do have an address, and they were working in that direction, and I actually think that a very compelling analysis is that the idea of a Palestinian unity government was the tipping point for the Israelis to go into Gaza and create this. So I think that's probably analysis we're thinking about.
Janine, you mentioned earlier this piece you wrote for Slate. I read a piece probably about 2 weeks ago or so that talked about the Israeli government clamping down on the search for those three, the media coverage, the search for those three yeshiva students, and how, in a sense, they ratcheted up the tension in Israel that seemed to presage, the rush to war, as it were. Can you talk about, in whatever shape or form you can, the way the media parallels official intentions or not?
Yeah, I just want to respond to Jess quickly, though. I agree with you that the Israeli rejection of the national unity government was in the backdrop here. I'm saying the pretext for, being able to go in and everything really started with that, because then the Israeli government blamed Hamas in the Gaza Strip for orchestrating that kidnapping, but I'm not even sure they don't think they provided any evidence of that at all.
There was no evidence,
there was a lot of, I think that's what, I think they're linked in a way, and one of the things, I think the national unity government point is an extremely important one, because one of the things the Israelis have been saying, and I'll get to Jonathan's question if I can, but is that they can't negotiate with the Palestinians when they are divided, because Mahmoud Abbas does not represent Gaza. But he can't negotiate, Bibi, with them when they're united, because Hamas wants to destroy Israel. So, and there's no way Hamas is going to really say, okay, we embrace Israel, before there's any kind of a final peace agreement, right? That's one of their cards. So I think that definitely the National Unity Government was a part of this, and I think it was one of the alternatives to a military offensive, right? To let that play out a little bit. Just let it play out. Give it a shot. It'll probably fall apart on its own, but let it play out, okay? Was one of the options. And there were a lot of other options, I think, and alternatives to what we're seeing in terms of military, if you want to deal with the Hamas rocket fire. Shaul Mofaz, he's no dove. He was a former, Minister of Defense and head of the Army Chief of Staff, says, let's give $50 billion in development to Gaza in exchange for disarmament, right? If you didn't read carefully, you missed that idea, right? It's like not even in part of the zeitgeist there. It's not even talking about it, So I think, the coverage of the three Israeli yeshiva students, the way it was reported in the Israeli media. I mean, they're referred to by their first names, for example. Elu abanim shelanu, these are our sons, right? It was like sort of everybody's sons. You see that kind of reporting right now on the Israeli soldier deaths, right? It's one big family there, right? So it got very personal, and people were very, shocked by the whole thing, because of what I said earlier, that it's really been pretty quiet here, and looking for someone to blame for that, right? So, but there was no discussion of, well, wait a minute, let's talk about our policy towards Hamas and Gaza. Is there an alternative to what we have right now? How did we get here? Why did this happen? There's none of that, really. It's a focus on loss, grieving, and how do we retaliate?
And among the questions from our audience are those about the idea of occupation. There are some who say the Gaza Strip is not occupied. The UN technically says it is occupied because of Israeli control of borders.
Try going there. Try living there. If you have any doubt that it's occupied, you just have to step 1 foot, if you can get in.
Right. So then what often happens is discussions tend to get stuck on the technical terms of occupation. What is occupation? And losing the bigger picture. I would ask you, Professor Bisharat, about the bigger picture, even if it's in terms of legal, from a legal standpoint or yeah. from your own personal standpoint.
Sure. Well, I do think that the, you know, sort of the sniff test that Jess proposes really is the best. Just go there. And if you imagine that you're in a free society, well, you know, that illusion will be dashed rather quickly. Let's understand something as well. Everywhere outside of the United States, it is universally held that Israel occupies the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. I suppose in Australia there was a foreign minister who had other ideas, but outside of that, virtually everyone, public, media, governments, everyone knows that the territories are occupied. There's no serious question about that in law outside of this country. It is only because of the relentless focus of pro-Israel media and pundits and the like that we in this country suffer under this illusion that there's really any question about it. In 2004, the International Court of Justice, all 15 judges, including the American judge, who was himself a descendant of a Holocaust survivor family, held that the territories are occupied. So there's the fact that there's any discussion about this at all is really a testament to the kind of the bubble in which we live.
I just want to.
Let me interrupt you. Okay, I just want to say something. You and I, John, we talked earlier about Edward Said. Mm-hmm. You've interviewed him. I interviewed him as well. A very prominent, maybe the most prominent Palestinian academic ever. He famously was on had dealings with both sides, right? But I'm just wondering. You know, he passed away about a decade ago. Is there something that he said in your many conversations with you that you think has relevance for today? I know one of the things he said to me before he died, and this was in 2004 or 5, was that he envisioned a Palestinian state by 2010. Now that has not happened. Is there anything that you can recall that you think he said that has relevance for you today?
Yeah, fundamentally, Edward Said articulated clearly that Israel should never have been created, that it was a historic injustice, and that there would be a Palestinian state. But I hasten to point out, and I would be remiss if I didn't, that Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip. It withdrew 22 settlements, 8,500 settlers, left behind hothouses, that they were immediately destroyed, that Hamas seized control in Gaza in 2007 in a coup in which members of the Palestinian Authority were butchered, killed. Just go back and read the press accounts. You know, I want to be crystal clear about this. In Israel, there is a feeling of willingness to compromise, but not at the expense of Israel's right to exist. I listened carefully to the idea that Hamas was not behind the murder of the 3 yeshiva students. I want to be crystal clear. The Israelis found the perpetrators, the people who were responsible for the tragic, immoral killing of that Palestinian boy. We are now almost 2 months past the murder of those 3 students, and no perpetrator has been brought to trial. Indeed, 2 people in Hamas were identified by name in the media, and no effort has been made for them to come forward to say anything. Now, let's be crystal clear. There are going to be recriminations back and forth, and if we sat together without a time constraint, our interpretations of history might be different. But if we are going to stop what is going on now, an escalation with, I believe, ominous consequences, we'd better forget about who did what to whom, and we'd better start negotiating. And that means that Hamas must change its covenant and must proceed to state a willingness to do just that. One last point, if I may. As a Jew, the most disturbing thing has been what has been happening in Europe. Have you been following the demonstrations? Chants of death to the Jews, kill the Jews, send the Jews to the ovens, gas the Jews, murder the Jews? Did you see what I can only call as a replication of Kristallnacht in Paris, in a Jewish neighborhood where windows were shattered of stores? Now, I raise this only because I want you to understand. There are ramifications beyond Gaza, beyond 2,000-plus missiles hitting Israel. This is now having a ripple effect across the world. And I wish that as an Islamic group condemned the expulsion of Christians in Iraq, that that same group would denounce the statements made about Jews. Because if you want to see emotions raised, you saw the French foreign minister, the Italian foreign minister, the German foreign minister stand together, and their bottom line was, this has no place in our society. I raise it because all of us want to see this stop, and this ripple effect must be stopped now, or it'll get a lot worse.
Let me move to Jess Ghanem. John talks about, in a sense, the higher level, the kind of the Jewish street or the Arab street or the European street, as it were. But the sort of families whose lives get lost often don't have any voice at all. Can you talk about whether people in Gaza actually have a voice in who actually represents them? Did they elect Hamas? No, but is there a representation there at the political level for, Gaza's civilians?
Well, I think I'd rather start with a kind of a painful recollection on my part. Jonathan, I was watching the real painful image of the Dutch remains, the real tragedy of the Dutch citizens that were killed on MH17 Malaysian Airways. And then I was literally brought to tears seeing how the caskets were brought. They were allowed to at least begin the process of respectfully and dignifiedly burying the dead. And what brought me to tears was seeing that, but also thinking about the thousands and thousands and thousands of Palestinians who are not going to be able to bury their dead in Gaza. Because as we speak now, we have thousands of, injured Palestinians who are unable to access medical care because of the blockade. We also have people under rubble right now who are either close to death or who are dead. And the inability of Palestinians to grieve with dignity and with respect, to bury their dead, being denied to them, is such a profound image that I think Americans don't see. The Europeans see it, the rest of the world see it, but we as Americans, we don't see this image. And in terms of the voice, I tell you this, Jonathan, every time I go to Gaza, I say to Palestinians, my colleagues and my friends, what do you want me, say to, Americans when I come back? And they always say the same thing. They say, ask them why they forgot about us, why the world has turned their back on us. And it brings me to tears to hear that, because they ask me that, and I never have a good answer. And so the idea of representation, Jonathan, does not exist in that kind of way.
For people here in the audience, I believe there's a microphone set up for people to ask questions. Is that correct? It is correct. So we have about 20 minutes left, and we would like to get in some live questions, as it were. I don't know how many we'll be able to get in. Hopefully some. The microphones are being set up now, so please, if you could start standing in line, we'll try to get two questions as possible. Janine, as people are lining up and maybe writing down other questions for the panelists, can you address any of what Jess said about that, representational governments, and how Israelis are represented or not by the Netanyahu government, and sort of that, you know, is he in a sense speaking for all Israelis, you know, when he says, okay, we're going to go into Gaza and destroy all these tunnels?
He's not speaking for all Israelis, but there is an enormous consensus in Israel right now that's supporting this military offensive. 80% of Israelis support it. By the last poll I saw, 94% of Israelis support the IDF's operations right now. And when I reached out to a prominent left-wing politician from the 90s, and I said, where are you guys on this? You know, why are you not speaking on this? And he said, it's almost like they feel like they can't, because of the overwhelming consensus in the country right now. If you anybody who reads Haaretz will read Gideon Levy, who is a prominent columnist there, who has been one of the few voices speaking out against this. And he's been labeled a traitor. He's been accosted. He's been, you know, I mean, it's a different kind of environment than I'd say past ones. But I just want to add to what Jess said. I remember when I reported from Gaza a lot in 2010, 2009, 2011, and before that. And I remember writing in the Washington Post, Palestinians lament. This is during the blockade, and everybody was talking about the goods and all this. And I was in the tunnels, and I've seen it, and I've been there. Okay, so they lament more where they can't go more than what they can't buy, right? It's this movement and access issue. Let's get rid of the freaking occupation term and the debate and, you know, and like Jordan. They can't go anywhere. Now, this has nothing to do with the rockets or anything. That's just the context for what's happening, okay? They want to be able to go. And, you know, when you talk to, I remember talking to a Hamas official as part of my reporting there. We're talking about stuff, and I just wanted to share this one quick anecdote. He said, by the way, Janine, what do they think about us? And I said, what do you mean, who? What are you talking about? He said, you know, in America. I said, well, the people maybe, I felt like he thought I was a political consultant or something. And I said, well, the people who have heard of Hamas in America, who pay attention to this stuff, they may remember that you used to blow up pizzerias in Jerusalem and kill a lot of kids. That's maybe what they'll think. And he said, really? That was like 10 years? You know, like it was like he was shocked because he was sitting there in a suit. He had just met with a minister from the Netherlands. And they were trying in a way, and I'm not saying, John, that they're not, that they don't want to get rid of Israel and all these other things in their charter. But I felt in that moment that there was some change, that Hamas had changed, and that at least it's worth a discussion in Israeli society about whether it's changed and to what degree.
Finally, we'll ask George, Professor Bisharat, if you know his thoughts on what Janine said there, and just about. Thank you. And just about, you know, the idea that peace is possible right now or is not.
Long-term peace is not possible, but a calm is certainly possible. And within roughly 24 hours of the first request for a ceasefire that came through Egypt and that Israel briefly respected, Hamas issued a proposal for a truce that had 10 conditions, many of which, some of which were probably unreasonable, but many of which have been endorsed by the international community. And the most important of them was the lifting of the blockade. I believe if, you know, we don't have to resolve all of the issues between the two peoples in order to achieve calm and to achieve a more stable situation. And Hamas has actually been pretty reliable. Whatever you think of its ideology, of military tactics that it's used and is using, it has pretty much honored its word in the ceasefires that have been negotiated in the period from November 2012 to the current flare-up. Hamas itself fired no rockets, and it managed to curb the rocket firing of other organizations to a very, very low level, and that border was the calmest it had been for a couple of years. And so I think that form of that level of calm and stability can be achieved, and I think it is long overdue that the siege of the Gaza Strip end so that people there can travel, you know, earn a living, export their goods, travel to study, get medical care, and all of those things.
Just another reminder to our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking about the current crisis in Gaza. The guests today are Professor George Bishart, a UC Hastings professor of law, Janine Zakaria, journalist and Stanford professor of communications, Dr. Jess Ghanem, a clinical professor of psychiatry and global health sciences at the UCSF School of Medicine, and John Rothman, radio host and chief political analyst at KKSF AM Radio. We're going to take questions now from our audience live, and we're going to start over here, please. And please may ask you to keep these two questions and to keep them short, as it were, as short as possible. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. Earlier, Janine spoke about Israel's thought that the whole world is against us, and so we should do what is in our interest because the whole world is against us. And there's a thought that that is somehow hyperbole. And I just want to ask those who are very learned about what's going on in the Middle East, why there is so much attention to Israel and not to what else is going on. When John spoke about the third largest city in Jordan right now is a Syrian refugee camp. And there are more Syrian children living in Lebanon right now than Lebanese children living in Lebanon. And six Christians were crucified last week. And there are hundreds of thousands who have died and millions who are displaced. And the world seems to be so much more concerned about what is going on in Gaza. Not that there aren't horrific things going on in Gaza, but it seems to me that the world is against Israel if they're paying so much more attention to what's going on in Gaza, and we are seemingly paying no attention to what's going on with the horrific atrocities in Syria.
Okay. Do one of you want to address anything? I just want to say that this is not a recent phenomenon, by the way. Lots of books, academic and otherwise, have been written about the overemphasis, according to many, placed on Israel-Palestine. But I think your question is a smart one to ask. Do any one of you want to address that?
I think it's completely wrong that these other crises don't get covered. I see news about lots of news about Syria. Lots of news about Iraq, lots of news about Ukraine. I think it's just incorrect to assume that there is inordinate focus on Israel. Were there inordinate focus in this country, I think that might be appropriate because of our engagement with that country. We are Israel's principal diplomatic backer in the world. We have exercised our veto authority in the United Nations more than 40 times. That's more than half of all of the veto powers we've ever exercised. We supply Israel with $3 billion of military aid a year, you know, promised for the coming 10 years. And, you know, we have extensive cultural and economic relationships with that country. So I think if there's greater focus, it's because we have possibly a greater capacity to play a positive role if we ever choose to do so.
Let's take a question here, please. Yes.
I have a question about what started all of this. I know Janine mentioned that she thought it was because of three 16-year-olds Israeli boys who were murdered, and Jess came up with another thought of somehow the breakup in the unity government somehow was the cause of it. And I'm curious why nobody's talking about the rockets, which started, I believe it was 1 week to 10 days prior to Israel's incursion into Gaza. And there was a time when Netanyahu specifically said, please stop the rockets, because if you don't, we're going to have no choice but go in. Why would you not assume that is the reason? And also, when the ceasefire came about, Israel abided by it for 5 hours while 70 rockets were fired into Israel. So it was not Israel who negated the ceasefire. Thank you.
Jess, do you want to address that?
Well, with all due respect to a very, you know, important question worth considering, I think the situation's obviously complex. I mean, Janine offered a hypothesis. I offered a hypothesis. To say that it's one thing, I think, really reduces it a very complex situation to something as, well, they fired the rocket when and there. I mean, George and I have both said on numerous occasions there's plenty of time when there's a very extended ceasefire where there are no rockets, and there's absolutely no change on the impact of the siege of Palestinians in Gaza. So if you want to take a 30,000-foot view of why this is happening, really, there's a very simple answer. Gaza is occupied. Palestinians have no freedom, dignity, or self-respect. Once Palestinians are free, there will be no rockets. It's really a very simple equation.
You know, I simply want to respond and point out, because this is the kind of back and forth thing you hear. And look how many people are here today, because this is something that does fascinate us. The rest of the Middle East is marginal compared to this issue. But I want to say very clearly, there is a problem. And the problem is that Israel exists at all. Because when you scratch the surface and you put aside all of the other issues, that's the obstacle. And I'm going to tell you right here and now that the Israelis are not going to disappear. And therefore, the Middle East is going to have to accept once and for all, and that includes Hamas, which has a political direction, and I read their material avidly. But one last point. You are absolutely correct that the kidnapping of the three yeshiva students and the immoral, unconscionable, retaliatory action is not the core of the problem. There will always be another incident until everyone is prepared to come to the table, recognize the realities of the situation, stop casting aspersions, and begin the process of dialogue, which, even if we have differences, we are doing right here in the Commonwealth Club.
Let's take a question over here, please. Yes?
For people on the radio, maybe they can't see, but I'm on the younger side here at the Commonwealth Club. And this question is for Mr. Rothman. As a young Jew kind of figuring out my identity, what does it mean for the Jewish soul to be involved in a conflict where we are denying another people a right to live, a right to travel, denying people the right to bury their dead? I mean, it feels like it conflicts with this idea I have of what it means to be Jewish. And so I ask, what does it mean for the Jewish soul to be involved in this conflict and to be in a powerful role stopping violence and not doing that?
Thank you for the question. I remember vividly a great moment of hope on September 13th, 1993, when on the White House lawn, the unthinkable happened. If you asked me who would come first, the Messiah or Yasser Arafat shaking hands with Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres, I would have put my money on the coming of the Messiah. There is one thing that I believe strongly. The Palestinians feel passionately about their right to freedom. They feel passionately about the injustice that they feel has been done to them. Israelis and Jews feel just as passionately that Israel not only has a right to exist, but must exist. How we reconcile two completely different circumstances, if I may, this program is titled a community forum on Gaza. When I was asked to come, my immediate question was, why is it only Gaza? Does no one realize that 3,000 rockets have been fired at Israel? That Israelis hear a siren and go into an air raid shelter? Does no one realize that on both sides there is pain? There is a determination to end the conflict. So my suggestion would be that the Commonwealth Club should adjourn to Jerusalem and hold a forum there which brings together people who may disagree but understand the imperative that we all face, to conclude some sort of peace.
Before we take another question, I want to give Janine a chance to do you want to say anything?
I want to say a lot. I don't know if you can tell. I'm kind of like.
You don't hide it, Janine.
I know. I don't have a poker face to ask my husband. I don't know. Ask me something more specific because I have so many things I want to say.
Okay. Well, then I will leave it at this. There is about 5 minutes left. Yeah.
Let them ask questions.
Yeah, we're going to take another question, and then feel free to jump in when needed. Yes, please.
Okay. In my view, all four of you are intelligent, admirable people who have a huge amount of relevant knowledge that should be considered by everyone. Each of you has a perspective that is well worth considering. So my question is there any possible way we could get you or people who share of your each perspectives together, not for an hour or two, but for very extended conversations where you could really be heard, really be understood by each other? You could find some way to sync up the information you have so you could agree about something?
I mean, I like hanging out with George and Jess and John, but it would be better if John Kerry could get some people together and get the job done over there.
That's true.
And for the record, there was something went viral this week of many thousands of things, and one of the things that went viral was this campaign to get to show Arabs and Jewish couples kissing. And essentially, the campaign was, we don't hate each other, we love each other. Now, these were photos of people who happened to be outside of Israel-Palestine, but it was proof, if you needed it in this day and age, that all things are possible. Let's take another question over here, please.
My question is also to John Rothman. You mentioned Europe and the disturbing images coming from there. And as a Jew, as a son of Holocaust survivors, I could not be more, you know, it couldn't be more disturbing to me. But on the same page, I'm equally disturbed by the images of young Israelis running on the streets of Haifa, Tel Aviv, and other cities and chanting death to the Arabs, and more than that, death to the leftists. And if you read Haaretz today, or yesterday was it, an interview with one of the members of a gang that declared that their mission is to destroy Arabs and leftists. I'm appalled by what the Israeli society is becoming as a result of this conflict, as a result of continuing occupation. And I'm asking you, don't you think that peace is desperately needed for the sake of the Israeli society, if not for anything else?
Oh, of course. And I want you to know, I agree. I believe that there should be free expression of all forms. But I also want you to understand my view that for every action, there's a reaction. Extremism or the perception of extremism begets extremism. I am delighted to say, and I think I can say it fairly, that the view you saw does not reflect Israeli society at all. But I would tell you that the tragedy in Europe, which you began with, is that it felt necessary for the foreign ministers of France, Italy, and Germany, and the chancellors of those countries, or presidents, to come forward with a strong condemnation. Maybe the answer is, in part, that whenever extremism rears its ugly head, we all condemn it, no matter where it is found.
We have time basically for one more question, and I'm sorry, I'm actually going to have the panelists say one final thing. I'll tell you what. I'm looking at you. Just if you can address your question in 20 seconds or less.
You made your introduction to the four speakers. You talked about the Palestinian. That's you, Jonathan. You talked about the Palestinian suffering and the number of children that were dead. Why didn't you mention that extensive tunnel system that Hamas has been building and did build over the many, many years, not only bring goods into Gaza, but also to tunnel under the Israeli cities and then kill as many Israelis as they could. I'm wondering why you didn't mention that. And why didn't you mention missiles going over Ben Gurion Airport, Sidora. Why didn't you talk about that? Why was your introduction biased?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked that. It's a good example of someone, to my mind, projecting his views onto a question. I could have easily done that. It would have lasted. It would have been a 5-minute introduction. And as you can tell, the panelists had plenty of room to talk about a wide range of topics that could be considered pro-Israel, anti-Israel, pro-Palestine, anti-Palestinian, whatever. So if you look at the whole hour, and I think we did a fantastic job of covering the range of issues, that's what you should be focusing on as far as I'm concerned. Did we do a good job in the whole hour? And I just want to say, this is a good time to do this, that we should thank our panelists here. And let me remind you who they are. There's Professor George Bishara at the UC Hastings Professor of Law. There's Janine Zakaria, journalist and Stanford Professor of Communications. There's Jess Ghanem, clinical professor of psychiatry and global health sciences, UCSF School of Medicine. And finally, there's John Rothman, radio host and chief political analyst at KKSF AM 910. And please reserve your applause. You can actually unreserve them. Please applaud the panelists. Thank you. We appreciate all your questions, and this broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is now adjourned.
Thanks. 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 Nice to meet you. See you. Maybe hope everything goes well.